there was to taste perception, you could mimic everything. Your favorite steak, baked potato and apple pie feast, or a nice spaghetti bolognese, employing only table salt, sugar, vinegar, quinine, and monosodium glutamate. Fortunately, there is more to gluttony than that, and that is where the sense of smell comes in. The sense of smell explains why, if you take two identical solutions of sugar water and add to one a sugar-free essence of strawberry, it will taste sweeter than the other. The perceived taste of wine arises from the effects of a stew of between 600 and 800 volatile organic compounds on both the tongue and the nose. That's a problem, given that studies have shown that even flavor-trained professionals can rarely reliably identify more than three or four components in a mixture. Expectations also affect your perception of taste. In 1963, three researchers secretly added a bit of red food color to white wine to give it the blush of a rosé. They then asked a group of experts to rate its sweetness in comparison with the untinted wine. The experts perceived the fake rosé as sweeter than the white, according to their expectation. Another group of researchers gave a group of oenology students two wine samples. Both samples contained the same white wine, but to one was added a tasteless grape anthocyanin dye that made it appear to be red wine. The students also perceived differences between the red and the white corresponding to their expectations. And in a 2008 study, a group of volunteers asked to rate five wines rated a bottle labeled $90 higher than another bottle labeled $10, even though the sneaky researchers had filled both bottles with the same wine. What's more, this test was conducted while the subjects were having their brains imaged in a magnetic resonance scanner. The scan showed that the area of the brain thought to encode our experience of pleasure was truly more active when the subjects drank the wine they believed was more expensive. But before you judge the enophiles, consider this. When a researcher asked 30 cola drinkers whether they preferred Coke or Pepsi, and then asked them to test their performance by tasting both brands side by side, 21 of the 30 reported that the taste test confirmed their choice, even though this sneaky researcher had put Coke in the Pepsi bottle and vice versa. When we perform an assessment or measurement, our brains do not rely solely on direct perceptional input. They also integrate other sources of information, such as our expectation. Wine tasters are also often fooled by the flip side of the expectancy bias, lack of context. Holding a chunk of horseradish under your nostril, you'd probably not mistake it for a clove of garlic, nor would you mistake a clove of garlic for, say, the inside of your sneaker. But if you sniff clear liquid scents, all bets are off. In the absence of context, there's a good chance you'd mix the scents up. At least that's what happened when two researchers presented experts with a series of 16 random odors. The experts misidentified about one out of every four scents. Given all these reasons for skepticism, scientists designed ways to measure wine experts' taste discrimination directly. One method is to use a wine triangle. It is not a physical triangle, but a metaphor. Each expert is given three wines, two of which are identical. The mission? To choose the odd sample. In a 1990 study, the experts identified the odd sample only two-thirds of the time, which means that in one out of three taste challenges, these wine gurus couldn't distinguish a Pinot Noir with, say, an exuberant nose of wild strawberry, luscious blackberry and raspberry, from one with the scent of distinctive dried plums, yellow cherries, and silky cassis. In the same study, an ensemble of experts was asked to rank a series of wines based on 12 components, such as alcohol content, the presence of tannins, sweetness, and fruitiness. The experts disagreed significantly on 9 of the 12 components. Finally, when asked to match wines with the descriptions provided by other experts, the subjects were correct only 70% of the time. Wine critics are conscious of all these difficulties. On many levels, the rating system is nonsensical, says the editor of Wine and Spirits magazine. And according to a former editor of Wine Enthusiast, the deeper you get into this, the more you realize how misguided and misleading this all is. Yet, the rating system thrives. Why? The critics found that when they attempted to encapsulate wine quality with a system of stars or simple verbal descriptors such as good, bad, and maybe ugly, their opinions were unconvincing. But when they used numbers, shoppers worshipped their pronouncements. Numerical ratings, though dubious, make buyers confident that they can pick the golden needle, or the silver one, depending on their budget, from the haystack of wine varieties, makers, and vintages. If a wine, or an essay, truly admits some measure of quality that can be summarized by a number, a theory of measurement must address two key issues. How do we determine that number from a series of varying measurements? And given a limited set of measurements, how can we assess the probability that our determination is correct? We now turn to these questions, for whether the source of data is objective or subjective, their answers are the goal of the theory of measurement. The key to understanding measurement is understanding the nature of the variation in data caused by random error. Suppose we offer a number of wines to 15 critics, or we offer the wines to one critic repeatedly on different days, or we do both. We can neatly summarize the opinions employing the average or mean of the ratings. But it is not just the mean that matters. If all 15 critics agree that the wine is a 90, that sends one message. If the critics produce the ratings 80, 81, 82, 87, 89, 89, 90, 90, 90, 91, 91, 94, 97, 99, and 100, that sends another. Both sets of data have the same mean, but they differ in the amount they vary from that mean. Since the manner in which data points are distributed is such an important piece of information, mathematicians created a numerical measure of variation to describe it. That number is called the sample standard deviation. Mathematicians also measure the variation by its square, which is called the sample variance. The sample standard deviation characterizes how close to the mean a set of data clusters, or, in practical terms, the uncertainty of the data. When it is low, the data fall near the mean. For the data in which all wine critics rated the wine 90, for example, the sample standard deviation is zero, telling you that all the data are identical to the mean. When the sample standard deviation is high, however, the data are not clustered around the mean. For the set of wine ratings above that ranges from 80 to 100, the sample standard deviation is 6, meaning that as a rule of thumb, most of the ratings fall within 6 points of the mean. In that case, all you can really say about the wine is that it is probably somewhere between an 84 and a 96. In judging the meaning of their measurement, scientists in the 18th and 19th centuries faced the same issues as the skeptical enophile. For if a group of researchers makes a series of observations, the results will almost always differ. One astronomer might suffer adverse atmospheric conditions. Another might be jostled by a breeze. A third might have just returned from a Madeira tasting with William James. In 1838, the mathematician and astronomer F.W. Bessel categorized 11 cases of random errors that occur in every telescopic observation. Even if a single astronomer makes repeated measurements, variables, such as unreliable eyesight or the effect of temperature on the apparatus, will cause the observations to vary. And so astronomers must understand how, given a series of discrepant measurements, they can determine a body's true position. But just because enophiles and scientists share a problem, it doesn't mean they can share its solution. Can we identify general characteristics of random error? Or does the character of random error depend on the context? One of the first to imply that diverse sets of measurements share common characteristics was Jacob Bernoulli's nephew Daniel. In 1777, he likened the random errors in astronomical observation to the deviations in the flight of an archer's arrows. In both cases, he reasoned, the target, true value of the measured quantity or the bullseye, should lie somewhere near the center, and the observed results should be bunched around it, with more reaching the inner bands and fewer falling farther from the mark. The law he proposed to describe the distribution did not prove to be the correct one, but what is important is the insight that the distribution of an archer's errors might mirror the distribution of errors in astronomical observations. That the distribution of errors follows some universal law, sometimes called the error law, is the central precept on which the theory of measurement is based. Its magical implication is that, given that certain very common conditions are satisfied, any determination of a true value based on measured values can be solved employing a single mathematical analysis. When such a universal law is employed, the problem of determining the true position of a heavenly body based on a set of astronomers' measurements is equivalent to that of determining the position of a bullseye given only the arrow holes or a wine's quality given a series of ratings. That is the reason mathematical statistics is a coherent subject rather than merely a bag of tricks. Whether your repeated measurements are aimed at determining the position of Jupiter at 4 a.m. on Christmas Day, or the weight of a loaf of raisin bread coming off an assembly line, the distribution of error is the same. This doesn't mean random error is the only kind of error that can affect measurement. If half a group of wine critics liked only red wines, and the other half only white wines, but they all otherwise agreed perfectly, and agreed perfectly consistent, then the ratings earned by a particular wine should not follow the error law, but instead should consist of two sharp peaks, one due to the red wine lovers and one due to the white wine lovers. But even in situations where the applicability of the law may not be obvious, from the point spreads of football games to IQ ratings, the error law often does apply. Many years ago, I got hold of a few thousand registration cards for a consumer software program a friend had designed for 8 and 9-year-olds. The software wasn't selling as well as expected. Who was buying it? After some tabulation, I found that the greatest number of users occurred at age 7, indicating an unwelcome but not unexpected mismatch. But what was truly striking was that when I made a bar graph showing how the number of buyers diminished as the buyer's age strayed from the mean of 7, I found that the graph took a familiar shape, that of the error law. It is one thing to suspect that archers and astronomers, chemists and marketers, encounter the same error law. It is another to discover the specific form of the law. Driven by the need to analyze astronomical data, scientists like Daniel Bernoulli and Laplace postulated a series of flawed candidates in the 18th century. As it turned out, the correct mathematical function describing the error law, the bell curve, had been under their noses the whole time. It had been discovered in London in a different context many decades earlier. Of the three people instrumental in uncovering the importance of the bell curve, its discoverer is one who least often gets the credit. Abraham de Moivre's breakthrough came in 1733, when he was in his mid-60s and wasn't made public until his book, The Doctrine of Chances, came out in its second edition 5 years later. De Moivre was led to the curve while searching for an approximation to the numbers that inhabit the regions of Pascal's triangle far beneath the place where I truncated it, hundreds or thousands of lines down. In order to prove his version of the law of large numbers, Jacob Bernoulli had had to grapple with certain properties of the numbers that appeared in those lines. The numbers can be very large. For instance, one coefficient in the 200th row of Pascal's triangle is 59 digits. In Bernoulli's day, and indeed in the days before computers, such numbers were obviously very hard to calculate. That's why, as I said, Bernoulli proved his law of large numbers employing various approximations, which diminished the practical usefulness of his result. With his curve, de Moivre was able to make far better approximations to the coefficients and therefore greatly improve on Bernoulli's estimates. The approximation de Moivre derived is evident if, as I did for the registration cards, you represent the numbers in a row of the triangle by the height of the bars on a bar graph. For instance, the three numbers in the third line of the triangle are 1, 2, and 1. In their bar graph, the first bar rises 1 unit, the second is twice that height, and the third is again just 1 unit. Now let's look at the five numbers in the fifth line, 1, 4, 6, 4, 1. That graph will have 5 bars. Again, starting low, rising to a peak in the center, and then falling off symmetrically. The coefficients are very far down in the triangle, leading to bar graphs with very many bars, but they behave in the same manner. If you draw a curve connecting the tops of all the bars in each bar graph, it will take on a characteristic shape, a shape approaching that of a bell. And if you smooth the curve a bit, you can write a mathematical expression for it. That smooth bell curve is more than just a visualization of the numbers in Pascal's triangle. It is a means for obtaining an accurate and easy-to-use estimate of the numbers that appear in the triangle's lower lines. This was de Moivre's discovery. Today, the bell curve is usually called the normal distribution and sometimes the Gaussian distribution. We'll see later where that term originated. The normal distribution is actually not a fixed curve, but a family of curves, in which each depends on 2 parameters to set its specific position and shape. The first parameter determines where its peak is located. The second parameter determines the amount of spread in the curve. Though it didn't receive its modern name until 1894, this measure is called the standard deviation, and it is the theoretical counterpart of the concept I spoke of earlier, the sample standard deviation. Roughly speaking, it is half the width of the curve at the point at which the curve is about 60% of its maximum height. Today, the importance of the normal distribution stretches far beyond its use as an approximation to the numbers in Pascal's triangle. It is, in fact, the most widespread manner in which data have been found to be distributed. When employed to describe the distribution of data, the bell curve describes how, when you make many observations, most of them fall around the mean, which is represented by the peak of the curve. Moreover, as the curve slopes symmetrically downward on either side, it describes how the number of observations diminishes equally above and below the mean, at first rather sharply, and then less drastically. In data that follow the normal distribution, about 68%, roughly 2/3, of your observations will fall within 1 standard deviation of the mean, about 95% within 2 standard deviations, and 99.7% within 3. A good way to get a feeling for how the normal distribution relates to random error is to consider the process of polling or sampling. You may recall the poll I described in Chapter 5 regarding the popularity of the mayor of Basel. In that city, a certain fraction of voters approved of the mayor, and a certain fraction disapproved. For the sake of simplicity, we will now assume each was 50%. As we saw, there is a chance that those involved in the poll would not reflect exactly this 50-50 split.